You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa. No mā haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. If I ake nei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government's fuel management plan. I also spoke to Professor of Climate Science and Physical Geography at Victoria University of Wellington, James Renwick, about 2025 being one of the hottest years on record and what can be done about it from a policy perspective. I also spoke to Principal Science Advisor with the Department of Conservation, Drew Bingham, about how these increasing temperatures impact conservation efforts. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Health Coalition Aotearoa Co-Chair and Professor of Population Nutrition and Global Health, Boyd Swinburne, about a new South Auckland food security report and its findings.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai texan on 5395. Wai marane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e aha ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere roki roke mā runga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho, mea haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Fuel prices across the country are continuing to rise, and concerns over a potential fuel shortage are growing. In response, the government has announced the National Fuel Response Plan late last week. The plan has four stages named Watchful, Precautionary, Managed, and Protected. The last two remain under consultation, and we're currently under only the first. Analysts have criticised the plan for being vague, especially in the later stages, and the early stages have been criticised for not doing enough. The watchful stage, the first, involves increased monitoring, data publications, coordination, and an ad campaign encouraging people to reduce fuel consumption. The government has responded to most critiques by comparing its response to that of the previous Labour government to COVID-19, which they've repeatedly criticised. They say government intervention is the wrong way to deal with a crisis, an idea which many in the public have questioned. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked him about the fuel crisis, what the government is doing, and how the previous government plays into all of this. The fuel crisis seems to be occupying a lot of space in at least our political discussions at the moment. What is the government offering to people to support with increased prices?
So from April, around 143,000 working families, I understand, with children will get an extra $50 a week to help, and that's through the in-work tax credit. And around about a further 14,000 working families will get a slightly smaller payment. And the aim of this is so that low to middle income working families with children who are not on a main benefit receive targeted and temporary support to deal with their energy and cost of living issues associated with the increase in the cost of the supply of fuel into New Zealand.
And as diesel gets more expensive, we're not only seeing price increases at the pump where the support is designed to assist people, but also in supermarkets and other retailers across the country as the cost of transporting goods goes up. Is the government open to providing more financial support if we start seeing cost pressures in other areas as well, or maybe other policies designed at addressing that?
Well, you make a good point. And in the design of the support policy, the government had considered different options. One could be to say reduce the excise tax paid on diesel or petrol at the pump, which is all about liquid fuel and subsidising people who use cars. But the point you made is entirely accurate, that the cost of diesel means that harvesting the food, you know, farmers' tractors use diesel, transporting it to supermarkets and so on, you know, all adds into the cost of living. And that is why providing an extra $50 a week to families with children who are working through InWork tax credit seem to be a much more practical and constructive way of delivering support to people who are experiencing, you know, the additional cost of fuel in so many different ways, not just at the pump.
And the government's been a bit flip-floppy on how serious this crisis has been. Nicola Willis was out at the start saying she was very confident. Then she came around and said, well, there were some concerns. And the government's now unveiled, or at the end of last week, unveiled its fuel alert system. What, I guess, do you make of the current situation? Is there cause for alarm in the New Zealand public? Is this something that's going to be over soon? What should people be focusing on?
Well, in terms of security of supply, the amount of fuel that New Zealand has on hand is relatively or almost unchanged since the United States and Israel commenced their military operation. And what we have seen is an increase of prices, which reflects essentially the fuel company's assessment of risk. Because while supply is not yet constrained into the New Zealand market, the risk that it might be shows up at the price of the pump. So it's important that government has a plan to deal with any potential risk to security of supply, and that's what the alert level plan that Minister Willis announced last week is meant to do. But right now, you know, the ship's on the way, our tanks are full. New Zealanders are experiencing increased costs, whether to their business or to their household, and that's why this government is focused on helping those families and households that need it most through targeted temporary support and, you know, to be clear, funded from within our existing operating allowance. This government is not borrowing money to help people. We are making trade-offs between other things that we could fund or wish to fund and actually helping families at this time.
Some analysts are looking at the government's current fuel restriction policy and maybe questioning it a little bit, looking to some of our allies or some of our providers who are already enacting stricter fuel restrictions than we're seeing here, and also looking forward to Easter weekend, which historically in New Zealand sees a lot of petrol usage coming up, and maybe that'll disrupt some of the government's figures a little bit. Are you confident in, or I guess what would you say to these analysts who are saying maybe New Zealand isn't taking a strong enough approach out of the gate to addressing fuel insecurity?
Well, I've seen lots of commentary, lots of people in the media wishing to go back to the days of lockdowns and, you know, 1 p.m. press conferences and, you know, governments telling people where they're allowed to go and when to stay home and put a teddy in the window. That is not this government's ethos. Those people were kicked out because Kiwis were sick of them. What they do need is for their government to plan to make sure that fuel is on the way and that our supplies are there, particularly for essential services. That's what the plan is for. But if you compare the way that New Zealand's government is responding to, say, other countries, the Philippines, for example, they rely almost exclusively on imported oil for all of their electricity and heating and other industrial activities. We're very fortunate in New Zealand that on some days, you know, 100% of our electricity is generated by renewables. We're in quite a different situation. And it's important that, you know, if people are concerned, they can be confident fuel's on the way. We've got a plan in the event that, you know, supply is disrupted and, you know, there is economic support coming for Kiwi families. But because of the trade-offs the government's made, you know, we're not borrowing to provide that support. The support they get will not add to inflation and make things worse. That's something this government is absolutely focused on.
You say that people should be confident in the government because of these announcements that have been put out. However, if we look at phase 3 and 4 of the fuel alert system, those are still under consultation, and especially with phase 4 when it talks about rules in place to ensure fair distribution of fuel and ensuring that critical services remain funded. When we think about those critical services, as we discussed earlier, that's things involving diesel, so moving goods from place to place, ensuring people can access things at supermarkets. Should we be confident if these, you know, are still getting consulted on, if the plans aren't out yet, they aren't available? There's, I mean, an understandable level of scepticism when this information isn't available, right?
Well, you only have to contrast it to the previous government during COVID, which locked Auckland down, put an artificial border around Auckland and said, truckies, you're going to need to obtain a pass to come and go from Auckland and show your papers at the border, send all the cops to Auckland's regional border and left our cities and towns and suburbs like where I live in West Auckland basically at the mercy of gang members roaming around on motorcycles with no helmets. I think New Zealand businesses, the transport sector, manufacturers would be quite happy to be consulted on what the plan might look like rather than have it made up in a minister's office in a panic. So, consultation's a good thing if it means that when the plan is finalised, it actually addresses all the risks that need to be managed in a fair way.
You've been comparing this a lot to the government's COVID response, and obviously these are two things responding to different issues, but it's very hard to avoid that comparison when it's a national response to a significant crisis that's showing up. You criticise the response, but at the time when the government was responding to COVID, it was intensely popular. I mean, in the 2020 election, we saw some of the biggest voter turnout and some of the biggest mandate for a government that New Zealand has ever seen. When the COVID lockdowns were happening, the public was confident that the government knew what they were doing. We had up-to-date information every day. We had regular announcements. We had plans put in front of us to look at. This government is going down a different path, and we can see that the public is less confident. A lot of people don't know the extent of the fuel crisis. People don't know what's going on. You've mentioned that it's an intentional decision from the government to not go down that same path, but is this something that worries the government, that people don't know what's going on, people are not confident in where we're going as a country?
Well, I think what is a worry, it should be a worry for all New Zealanders, is scaremongering and people in the media and commentators who actually don't have much to add, weighing in and saying we need some kind of plan. As I saw recently in the newspaper, that looks like lockdowns and carless days and telling people when and how to drive. But in the end, you know, the price of fuel is a very strong signal to people to drive less. I was out and about in Auckland yesterday, and I was surprised at how light the traffic was on the road. So I think Kiwis are responding to the price signal first. Let's just go back to COVID. The first couple of months of COVID, it was quite clear during a global pandemic, the government needed to take a precautionary approach. But by the time you got to the last Auckland lockdown, not only were people fed up with it, it didn't make any sense to isolate Auckland from the rest of the country, where 40% of the economy is, over 50% of our imports come in. It was deeply unpopular. And I'll tell you how unpopular it was. When Kiwis had a chance to vote out that Labor Green government, they voted it out and they sent them to the opposition benches, and they've returned to the coalition parties, including ACT, into government. So we're taking a measured approach. We're thinking really deeply and carefully about what the impacts would be of different types of controls and different sectors. And, what you'll see when the plan is finalised is something that that shows a fair, reasonable response to the level of risk to New Zealand's security of supply when it comes to liquid fuels like diesel.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the fuel crisis, what the government's doing about it, and how the previous government's COVID response relates.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Health Coalition Aotearoa and Healthy Families South Auckland have recently released a report looking at food security issues in South Auckland and actions which can be taken to improve access to affordable, nutritious food in these areas. The report recommended multiple measures which could be taken, such as expanding Ka Ora Ka Ako, the Healthy School Program's lunches program, for a sugary drinks tax, giving communities a say in how many junk food outlets are in their neighbourhoods, and allowing Auckland Council to better utilise underused public land for kai initiatives. Its main call to action, however, is to ensure solutions are community-led with a collaborative approach from local and central government. To guarantee those suffering are being put first in systematic fights against the industrial food complex and the economic inequality. To discuss the report and its findings, I spoke to Health Coalition Aotearoa co-chair and Professor of Population Nutrition and Global Health, Boyd Swinburne. Now, can you tell us a bit about this food security report that the Health Coalition of Aotearoa and Healthy Families South Auckland put together?
So a coalition of groups that's really concerned about food insecurity, especially in places like South Auckland, got together and we conducted a bunch of interviews with local community members, organisations, with the local council and so on, to understand that from their point of view and what could be done about it. So from the interviews, we developed some mapping of the food system there and came up with several potential areas for action which can improve food security and what's called food sovereignty, which is a sort of condition where people have a bit more agency and a feeling of control over the food in their environment.
As you said there, the report identifies multiple potential actions, but specifically highlights how it's important to have a collective response to an issue like this. Can you expand on this and say how certain individual policy isn't enough?
Well, this is a big and difficult problem, and right at the core of it is the economic problem of people not having enough money and therefore not being able to put food on the table. In places like South Auckland, it's horrendous. More than 40% of kids in South Auckland come from households where they run out of money on a regular basis and can't put food on the table. So this is just not good enough for a country like New Zealand. The causes are complex and the solutions will need to be multiple, which is why we've come up with a series of policy responses that we'll be putting to local and central government.
And could you just tell us about some of those responses and go into, is this a combined response from council and the national government you need?
It is. We're focusing primarily on local council, on Auckland Council, but in fact a lot of the authority that comes to local government does come from the central government, so sometimes legislation is needed to be able to give local government the powers to make a difference. So let me just go through some of the things that we're calling for. The first thing is around lifting the whole food, the healthy food system, the local food system in South Auckland. And the industrial food system that we live with largely supplies ultra-processed food. Yes, you can get whole food, but the focus of the community is being able to lift the whole food production through community gardens, urban farming, access to social supermarkets, those sorts of things, which really give people more of a choice on whole food. So that is something that's in the council domain. They can support increased urban agriculture and home gardens and community gardens. So that's a big focus for the community. The second area is lifting the school food program, Ka Ora Ka Ako. That is a very powerful program for food security, and we've seen the effect that that can have in its original version when it was first introduced on improving local food production. The current version that we have now, with it all being produced centrally, is not very good for local food production, but the original version was. So there's a call to take that back to what it was before. That will stimulate local food production and links with school food. The third area is around reducing the impact of the industrial food system. Places like South Auckland are just swamped with fast food outlets and junk food outlets. These commercial organisations really prey upon and exploit people who are struggling. And there should be ways that the community can say, no, we don't want another KFC opening up next to a primary school. At the moment, the council and the community have no say in where fast food outlets are placed. and they have no say in whether there's already sufficient or whether they're already swamped with these things and they don't want any more. So we're calling for kind of more of a licensing approach like we have for alcohol outlets, and that will give communities a bit more say over the area. And the other thing that communities are calling for is an increase in their capabilities and capacity to be able to learn about food, to grow their own food, more about cooking and working with whole foods. So lifting skills and capabilities and capacity within communities.
The report said that while there are multiple factors to this issue, the most powerful one is household economics. Can you explain how low-income households in particular are kind of systematically pushed into eating this unhealthy food?
So at the core of this is the economic system, and this has created the poverty that we're seeing rising in this country. We're seeing all of this displayed as food insecurity and multiple other stressors that families on low incomes. Now, if you've got 40% of kids coming from households that have food insecurity, this is not because the parents are sitting on their hands or watching TV all day. You know, yes, we have an unemployment rate of about 5%, but almost all of this poverty is amongst working families. And this has been designed into our economic system. We've seen it develop since this neoliberal economic system started in the mid-80s, and it's just getting worse and worse. So it's a very deep and core problem that's been building over decades. That's not going to be fixed in a hurry by local council. That really does require a turnaround in our economic thinking, and not just focused on increasing GDP as this current government is focused on, but saying how can the economy serve us better as a community? How can we get people fed from a country that produces enough food for 40 million people, and yet we have so much hunger and starvation in this country? So it does require a major thinking of our economic system. When people are in poverty and they're struggling for time as well as money, they might be working two jobs, then time becomes of the essence. And this is where fast food and easily prepared food, which is not good for their health, does come into it, and where people kind of get exploited in this way with just rows and rows of fast food outlets in the suburb.
That was Health Coalition Aotearoa co-chair and Professor of Population Nutrition and Global Health, Boyd Swinburne, speaking to me about a new food security report by Health Coalition Aotearoa and Healthy Families in South Auckland.
We'll be right back after this short break. Text in your thoughts for 5395. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
What can I get for you?
Yeah, can I grab a funky wasp?
Smooth or seedy?
Just how it comes is fine.
Son of a bitch.
So quite a complicated drink then.
What? Yeah, I'm gonna be 37.50, mate. Actually, just make it 37, because I like your attitude.
Cocktail Corner, 5:30 every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive. Thanks to the Hollywood Avondale.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95bfm.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Of course, it is within this...
Hey,
Do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed. Some of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335. If you
think your contribution... Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
Welcome back to the Wire on 95BFM. That was Audrey by Toombs.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
A report published by the World Meteorological Organization found that 2025 was the second or third hottest year on record. As temperatures increase due to climate change and emissions, the world's governments are seeing a similar increase in pressure to act. In New Zealand, often the narratives around climate change are that our impact through generating emissions or through reducing emissions would be minimal, given our small population. Despite that, the impact of climate change on our country and on our Pacific allies is significant. To discuss what New Zealand can do in the face of rising temperatures and what our role is in responding to climate change, I spoke to Professor of Climate Change and Physical Geography at Victoria University of Wellington, James Renwick. Last year, we've seen in the recent report, is the second or third hottest year on record. What's New Zealand's contribution, I guess, to increasing emissions? What are our biggest emitters? What are we making in the climate change space?
Yeah, well, our biggest emissions of carbon dioxide, which is the longest-lived greenhouse gas, come from transport and industry. So people driving cars and all of the industrial uses of fossil fuels. But one of New Zealand's major contributions to global warming is methane emissions from agriculture. So methane only stays in the air for 10 to 15 years, but while it's up there, it is much more powerful as a warming agent than carbon dioxide is. So roughly, it depends how you measure it, but roughly half of our emissions come from agriculture and the other half from transport and industry and various other smaller players.
And because we're a small country, I think it often the narrative around New Zealand's climate management is often either that we don't need to care about the stuff that we're emitting, or that policies to reduce emissions and to alleviate climate impact would be redundant given our impact is quite small. Are these narratives true, or is there a bit of a grey area in between?
Those narratives are not true. You know, New Zealand's per head of population is one of the highest emitters in the world, and our economy has benefited hugely from burning fossil fuels. So, you know, it's not like this country gets a free pass because we don't have many people living in it. You could take any group of 5 million people around the world and they could say, well, we don't add much to the problem. We don't need to do anything. It's just a way of avoiding responsibility, essentially. We need to get to zero emissions globally, and that means globally every country has to get to zero. So, yeah, there's, like I said, there's no free pass for us just because we don't have a very large population. We're doing as much as any other country per head of population to push this problem along.
And so now if we're thinking about policy solutions, ways we can act on emissions to reduce that and reduce our carbon impact, and also on the flip side, I guess, alleviating the effects of climate change as they start to spread across the world. I mean, with the highest or second or third hottest year on record, you know, that's going to have an impact on people, on wildlife. How are we, what policies can we introduce?
Well, anything we can do to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels is a good idea. And, you know, we've seen in recent weeks for other reasons that reducing our dependence on fossil fuels is a good idea. So, you know, electrifying as much as possible, making the vehicle fleet fully electric. I see the government's announced today funding to double the number of EV chargers around the country. Excellent work. Subsidising electric vehicles, subsidising rooftop solar panels, putting in wind farms, you know, moving away from burning coal to generate electricity, moving away from burning oil and coal to power industry, and definitely moving away from using petrol and diesel to get both freight and people moving around the country. So those are the sort of obvious targets, I guess. And so if the government can facilitate the uptake of electric vehicles and using, and not just for individuals in their homes, but also for freight movements and industry and so on, that would be a big step forward. Our transport emissions have been the fastest growing area of emissions over the last 30 or so years. So, generating as much electricity as possible from renewable sources and all the other ways we use fossil fuels around transport and industry and so on, moving away from those and moving those towards renewably powered energy sources is the way to go. And you know, this is pretty well known. It's been talked about in Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports for many years. Governments are very well aware of this. They just need to take the action to make it happen.
And the government's climate policy has come under fire recently in court, but the case has been brewing for quite a while for various issues, the main one being the emissions reductions through planting more trees as opposed to actually reducing emissions at the source level. What do you make of this? What do you make of the government's policy and the subsequent case against it?
Good question. You know, the government's saying that we're on track to meet our targets and we're doing all the right things. And yet, when you look at the changes in policy that have happened with this government, they seem to be going backwards. You know, they've taken away subsidies for electric vehicles. And yes, they've just put a bit of money into electric chargers, but their goal of 10,000 around the country is still a long way off. They're putting money into building roads and they don't want to have cycle lanes. A whole lot of things are suggesting this government is not actually that interested in reducing carbon dioxide emissions or agricultural emissions. You know, they've backed away from charging for methane emissions on farms. So it's hard to reconcile all that with their claims that, you know, everything's hunky-dory. Yes, planting trees, that is a sort of a short-term not a solution. It's a way of buying a little bit of time. You know, those trees will absorb a bit of carbon dioxide while we come up with ways to reduce the actual gross emissions. And that's the bit that seems to be missing in this country right now. You know, the right trees in the right place can be good things for all sorts of reasons, like biodiversity and slope stability, etc. But just firing in pine trees all over the place does not really help anyone. And yeah, I'm a bit concerned about that kind of thinking, that we can just plant trees and we don't have to worry about doing anything else. It is absolutely the wrong way of thinking about the problem.
And some of that thinking comes from this idea, I guess, that we can continue to emit a large amount of fossil fuels as long as we make up for it with an equal or roughly equal number of trees, with this sort of net zero mindset, right, that New Zealand wouldn't produce any extra emissions. Is the world, now that we've seen, you know, that this report and we've seen increasing impacts of climate change, is the world in a state where every country could go net zero and things would be fine? Or do we have to go net negative almost and start reducing emissions more actively?
Yeah, another great question. We do actually have to go net negative. Depends where you want to stop with global warming. You know, 1.5 degrees is the bottom of the Paris Agreement range. 2 degrees of warming is the top of the range. Well, it's too late to stop at 1.5 degrees. We've only had 1 year above that threshold so far, but it's inevitable that we'll have every year above that by 2030. So, you know, we couldn't reduce emissions fast enough to stop that. Even stopping at 2 degrees, we'd need to see pretty serious action on reducing emissions globally. And I note from this latest report that actually in 2024, global emissions of carbon dioxide were the highest ever recorded. So we're pushing this up into the air faster and faster all the time. Despite all the talk about the Paris Agreement and everything, you know, no one's actually taking the action we need to take. So getting to net zero, okay, that would stop warming at whatever level it's at when we get there. But if we want to get back to something like the climate we used to have, yeah, we need net negative emissions. That is, we need to be pulling greenhouse gases out of the air actively. And I honestly don't know if that can be done. Sure, you can plant lots more trees, but that doesn't actually do it. There's not enough land to plant all the trees you'd need. And there's no other technology that anyone's aware of that would do the job either. So hoping for negative emissions is dangerous, I think, because there's nothing on the horizon that would really do it at the scale we need. So what we need to do is reduce emissions of greenhouse gases as absolutely fast as possible, starting right now. And like I just said, that the indicators show that we're going in the opposite direction. We're emitting more and more, faster and faster every year. So we have to wean ourselves off these fossil fuels for powering the global economy as soon as we possibly can.
That was Professor of Climate Science and Physical Geography at Victoria University of Wellington, James Renwick, speaking to me about policy responses to high temperatures driven by climate change. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Spisky by Phoebe Rings.
La 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 la
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Great No One by The Beths.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
The high temperatures exposed in the report from the World Meteorological Organization also pose significant risks for our native wildlife, particularly our shorebirds, fish, and alpine birds. As we see a change in the needs of our native species, many of which are already endangered, the response from the Department of Conservation must also change. To discuss what DOC is doing as climate change continues to impact conservation efforts, I spoke to Principal Science Advisor with the Department of Conservation, Drew Bingham. The thing we're talking about today is this new report about last year being the second or third hottest year on record. Pretty big deal for the environment, for climate change, but also in New Zealand, right, for our native species. What do temperatures do to our native species, to our wildlife and to our environment?
Yeah, so warmer temperatures, they can really impact our species a few different ways. So the temperatures themselves can stress out the animals and our plants as well. And, the same way that we get hot and don't like heat waves, animals can have the same thing happen to them. But over the long term, those warmer temperatures and changes in rainfall can also, shift around where the plants and animals live, so much larger changes as well.
And a lot of people, when they think about increasing temperatures, will think about rising ocean temperatures, because that's one of the big things that get discussed. Is that one of the key factors here? And are there other rising temperature concerns as well outside of the water?
Yeah, so the rising temperatures are one of the big things that are causing sea level rise. So they're melting, the glaciers and the ice in the Antarctic and the Arctic, and just warmer water takes up more space. And so that's a really big contributor to sea level rise. And that's obviously going to have really big impacts on animals that live along the shorelines and that are exposed to, bigger storm waves and those sorts of things, especially are some of the seabirds that live right at sea level and have their nests right there.
And so if we're thinking about DOC's work with all of these native animals, many of whom will be endangered, and we're thinking about conservation as these animals' behaviours change and adapt to these new circumstances, how too does DOC's behaviour change and adapt to continue to meet the needs of these animals?
Yeah, so on the one hand, I guess our work doesn't change. One of our big focuses right now is on supporting our species through controlling predators and pests. Sorry, I'll do that again for you. So in some ways, our work doesn't change that much. One of our big focuses has always been on controlling predators and... sorry.
That's all good. Take all the time you need.
Okay. So in some ways, our work doesn't change that much. One of the things we've been doing for a while is doing work to control predators and pests to help our native species. And taking the pressure off from those other stresses helps those species deal with the stresses from climate change. So the more pressure we can take off from those other sources, the better they'll be able to deal with the increasing extreme weather events that they're going to face now and in the future. But we're also doing work right now to understand how climate change is going to change the risk for the species and ecosystems into the future. We know we're just in the opening act of climate change right now, and so understanding those risks and how they're going to change is really key for us to be able to start planning how we can protect them going forward.
And it's quite worrying, right? With climate change, the impacts continuing and getting worse as well. The second or third hottest year on record, these are risks that aren't going away. They're just getting worse. And thinking about our native species, many of them are already struggling. How real is the risk to some of our native species in Aotearoa from climate change as these effects worsen?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely really concerning for us. We're already seeing impacts from extreme weather events on our native species. We had a heat wave in 2022 23 that summer, where we had temperatures over 40 degrees in the South Island in the Canterbury Braided Rivers, where the black-fronted terns live. We were actually doing a project to see if putting shelters out there for the chicks to take shelter in from those extreme temperatures would help as a way, as something we can do to help protect them and to help them deal with climate change. But we've seen other impacts too around around the motu. We've seen hoiho, the penguins down by Dunedin, who when we have marine heat waves, they have a really hard time finding their preferred food, and so that can affect how their survival. And we've seen extreme storms impacting birds like Tari'iti or Fio, which are these ducks that live on the river. And for example, like Cyclone Gabrielle, when that came through and it caused all that flooding, it was really devastating for some of the Fio that live on the rivers up in Hawke's Bay and Tarafiti.
And so now, I mean, you've mentioned it a little bit here and there, but if we're moving into the future and developing a conservation policy, a broader conservation policy that is working for our species in a world that is being affected constantly by climate change, what does that policy look like and how does it differ from what DOC's doing right now?
Yeah, so at DOC, we have a Climate Change Adaptation Action Plan. We've had it since 2019, and we've really been accelerating work on it over the last few years. And that plan will help us understand what the risks to the species are and ecosystems are. And we've already really gotten stuck into that work, and we're beginning now we're starting to understand those risks to be able to start building the planning for how we deal with those risks into the future. And what we do see is, you know, risks really accelerating, especially after 2050. And that sounds like a long way off, but it isn't really, especially when we're planning for protecting our native species. And so things like understanding how their habitat is going to change now and into the future is really important so that we can understand where they might shift to in the future and make sure that those types of habitats are available and they're preserved for them then.
And it sounds like DOC's got you guys have a lot of work cut out for you. And I can imagine that this will take a lot of effort on your part and also a lot of support. What kinds of things could DOC be asking of from individuals, from communities, from the government to help get this plan through in the future?
Well, getting ready for climate change is one of those things where every little bit helps, and actively giving back to nature and every bit of naturing helps. Even things like, joining a local trapping network or your local conservation group can help, because anything we can do to strengthen the species right now and our native plants and animals, anything we do to strengthen them now just helps them have that resilience for when that, you know, heat wave comes through or the drought or the next big storm.
That was Principal Science Advisor with the Department of Conservation, Drew Bingham, speaking to me about how conservation efforts change as global temperatures increase due to climate change.
That was The Wire.
Ida te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, Health Coalition Aotearoa Co-Chair Professor Boyd Swinburne, Professor of Climate Science and Physical Geography at Victoria University James Renwick, and Principal Science Advisor with the Department of Conservation Drew Bingham. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.